You are listening to the 2018 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust Leadership Advance Conference. This year's conference theme was Listening to Wisdom, Hearing the Voices of Our Great Cloud of Witnesses. The first session is led by Terry Stokesbury and Sandy Richter.
I am so excited to be among you. I always am thrilled when I get invitation from the Murdoch Trust. You all are amazing, may I just say, totally badass people. And just being in your presence and knowing what you do, I am humbled by this opportunity. So Terry asked me if I would launch our time together by dealing with wisdom literature, because of course our theme for today and tomorrow is this issue of listening well. So the wisdom of listening well. He has asked that we would start this very conference listening to the voice of the ancient scriptures, in which we can hear the heartbeat of our Creator, where we can pause over His wise counsel. And I don't know about your life, but the word pause is not really in my vocabulary. So we're all going to pause for these next 26 hours, pause from our breakneck pace to sit at His feet and learn something that perhaps we have not learned before. That's this morning's agenda. And as Terry has shared, we are also going to be working on learning to listen to the people around us. And that will be tomorrow morning's agenda for me. So it is my great privilege in this mix to launch us with our first task, that being the task of listening to the ancient voice of Scripture and to ancient, and to listen well. So of course we're moving into wisdom literature, or as I like to introduce it to my students, would you like to read my subtitle? Go ahead. How Not to Be Stupid for the Rest of Your Life. I'm gonna say that all together again. How not to be stupid for the rest of your life. All of a sudden, my emerging adults sort of wake up when they realize, oh yeah, maybe I don't want to be stupid for the rest of my life. And if your Hebrew is still fresh, you will read here your Yirat Adonai Rashith Da'at Chokmah. In other words, the answer is in the slide. How not to be stupid for the rest of your life? The fear of Yahweh. That is the beginning of wisdom. We have some more contemporary definitions of this idea. Let me offer you one here. A holistic, integrated, principle-centered approach for solving personal and professional problems. With penetrating insights and pointed anecdotes, wisdom literature, aka Stephen Covey, reveals a step-by-step pathway for living with fairness, integrity, service, and human dignity. Principles that give us the security to adapt to change and the wisdom and power to take advantage of the opportunities that change creates. So Stephen Covey and his best-selling book, now granted they're emerging from a Mormon belief system and you might want to check that theology at the door, but the idea here is that the principles of success are international. The principles of success are actually a very secular genre. In fact, represented in this room are probably dozens of authors and dozens of consumers of leadership material, wisdom literature, self-help books, Bill Gates' 10 Most Effective Principles to Making $1 Million Before You're 27. That, in many ways, is what wisdom literature is. Now, like Covey's book, wisdom literature is largely, again, a secular genre, and probably the most misunderstood and misapplied genre in the Hebrew Bible, because we hand out New Testaments to new converts that have the book of Proverbs slapped on the back, and we never give them any introduction to what it is we've just slapped on the back of their New Testament. This genre permeated the ancient Near East. We can find it in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, and everywhere in between. And based on its value in the ancient world, it was borrowed into our Bibles. Now, granted, as we will say many times before this morning is over, it was cleaned up and passed through a Yahwistic lens, and I'm just saying the name Yahweh with an istic at the end, passed through a Yahwistic lens before landing in our canon, but for us to understand it well, we're going to need some context. So because I'm an historian and an archaeologist, the context we're going to start with is, when were our sages writing? And there is good evidence that the wisdom literature of the ancient world and of our Bibles were indeed evolving collections that began entering our canon as early as the United Monarchy. And as a wise saying came to be known, it was added to the Book of Proverbs as a dialogue addressing the meaning of life rocks somebody's world. It was attached to a biblical character and placed into our biblical text. Again, it was always cleaned up and passed through this Yahwistic lens. But even so, this literature, this genre, came from all around Israel's world. And it was claimed or rejected in the canon by how well it might adapt. So we are looking at the United Monarchy. This is somewhere, according to the modified chronology, about 980 to 931 BC, or for the archaeologists among us, Iron 2A. I just can't not do that. And of course, the great champion of wisdom literature, as you know so well, is the third king of this United Monarchy, this superhero, drum roll please, the indisputable, amazingly wise King Solomon, heir of David. Now, my guild is actually still debating whether or not there actually was a United Monarchy. If you go to the Society of Biblical Literature, the American Academy of Religion, we're going to argue about this for, 40, 60 more years. But be comforted by the fact that the archaeologists are actually fairly convinced that there was a United Monarchy. The irony of this is it's the folks in biblical studies who struggle with this, not the folks who are actually in the dirt. And I'm just going to whip through a few things here. Jane Cahill, who is a name of names in the archaeological world, 2004, Jerusalem in David and Solomon's time. It really was a major city in the 10th century. Alat Mazar is digging right now in the City of David excavations and discovering monumental architecture. We have the inimitable Dan Stila. I love this piece. Dug up as a victory stele up in Tel Dan back in the summer of 1993. What were you doing that summer? I was teaching Hebrew at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And this piece was discovered, a victory stele from an Aramean king. And right here in pre-exilic script, someone in 850 BC mentions that they defeated both the king of Israel, that would be the northern kingdom, and the Beit David. Come on, guys. 850 BC, that puts the stele closer to our heroes than you and I are to Abraham Lincoln. Then we have this lovely Kirbit Kayafa inscription that was just discovered in 2008. It's transitional script, but what it shows is that there was actual diplomatic mail going back and forth between Jerusalem and Philistia as early as 1051 BC. So, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and perhaps next time I visit, there will actually be a United Monarchy. Okay, so taking just at face value that there was one, this is the first era in which the nation of Israel finally gets to catch its breath. Saul has been the transition figure. We've had Philistines everywhere. Is he going to make it? Are they going to take it? We can't tell. David comes in as the airborne ranger and finally secures all the borders and defeats all the bad guys. And when he last lays his head on his pillow and hands his kingdom over to Solomon, at last the borders are secure, the battles have been fought, the capital has been won, and Solomon is swimming in the resources and the advantages of a secure kingdom and a stable citizenry and control of the international trade routes. And for all you business people out there, you know what that means. So for the first time, Israel can put down its weapons and the all-consuming realities of a 24/7 schedule of a subsistence economy and actually find space for royal patronage of the arts. And that royal patronage is going to take its first form in David's first two collections in the Book of Psalms, and Solomon beginning the collection of the wisdom writings. And of course, it is Solomon who's associated with the incorporation of wisdom writings into the Old Testament. Why? Well, you know, you've read the story. The young king has just taken the throne, and after his inaugural ball, he falls asleep, and Yahweh comes to him in a dream and says, "What do you want? I will give you anything." And Solomon, wise man that he is, although he's only an emerging adult himself, he says, "I'm only a child. I need to be taught." What is the quote? "To be a great teacher, one has to start by being teachable." The older I get, the harder it is for me to read that quote to myself. To be a great teacher, one has to start by being teachable. And so Yahweh is pleased. So we turn to 1 Kings 3, and it reads, "And the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, 'Since you have asked for this and not for a long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do just as you've asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be anyone after you. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings." Switch out the word king for CEO, and you're starting to get a feel for what Solomon is being promised. "And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as your David, your father, did, I will give you a long life." And so we move on. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sands on the seashore. Do you remember that phrase? Sands on the seashore? Oh, that would be Abraham. And a breadth of understanding. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East. Woo-hoo, big claim. And greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. We need to keep in mind that our heroes were the backwoods hillbillies of the ancient Near East. I hate to break this to you. The superpowers are Egypt and Mesopotamia. So when Solomon is compared to these great kings, this is a very big deal. He was wiser than any other man, the scripture says, and his fame spread to all surrounding nations. That's what I want, famous. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005, kind of like Charles Wesley. I'm hoping he had more tunes, though. Just asking. Only the Wesleyans are laughing. Okay, so he described plant life, the cedar of Lebanon. He also taught about animals and birds. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. And as a result of his great wisdom, I know this passage looks dense, but the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Okay, direct quote of the Abrahamic covenant. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. Yay! That's what we want, right? That's how you get elected. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms. It doesn't matter what your platform is. As long as everybody's got two cars and money in their checkbook, you're in. Okay, and Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subject all his life, and they had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel from Dan to Beersheba lived in safety, each man under his own vine and his own fig tree. Solomon had 4,000 stalls of chariot horses. I actually have a dissertation on my shelf that describes exactly what it takes to prepare one horse for chariot battle. 7 years of training. So he has how many chariot horses and chariot riders to go with them? 12,000 horses. The district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for King Solomon, who came to the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. What are we reading here, folks? We're reading success. Success! Military success, political success, economic success. What else could a CEO ask for? We know from the same passage that Solomon had extensive court personnel. He established a highly efficient and demanding taxation system. A burgeoning economy resulted where silver was as common as stone and cedar as common as sycamore. Now, that might not sound like a big deal to you, but the sycamore in Israel is not the sycamore in North America. It's kind of this ugly little shrub tree. And cedars, well, they were considered the great prize of warfare from Gudea in 3000 BC all the way through the modern period. So it is a big deal. He was indeed the first emperor and perhaps the only emperor in Israel's experience. And so this is the success that he acquires. Now, with this success, you can anticipate that it will come with bureaucracy. You might not expect, or actually you're all directors of organizations, bills and building. Those are our three B's when it comes to Solomon. The scholars will say that he accomplishes a total transformation in Israel's political and economic life. Rapidly expanding command economy. That means redistribution, trade routes, ports. It means ka-ching, ka-ching of toll routes. Building programs. This man will transform a 15-acre Jerusalem into a regal, ritual 35-acre Jerusalem, as you know it in your history books. He will fortify his military outposts, governmental expansion. Why? Because of wisdom, or at least that's how the story starts. And just to give you some images here, that little red outline that you see down here, this is David's city. This purple outline, that's Solomon's city. What he does is he attaches two high topographical points. He builds the Milo in between the fill, a huge building platform, so that when he's done what started off looking like this, oh, and up there is just a threshing floor, looks like this. This is the Washington, D.C. of Israel. It is full of monuments and monumental building, and it came at a very high price. All right, Solomon's successes, a maritime fleet. The Israelites have never had a maritime fleet. They don't do water. And he has actually gotten control of two different ports, his own port down in Eilat, and he's taken control of Tyre and Sidon through alliance. That's huge. The Phoenicians are the Taiwan of the ancient world. Military innovations all over the place. Solomon gathers together chariots and horsemen. He refortifies the city. This guy is just busting the doors off. International alliances. How do you think he came up with his international alliances? Oh, that would be the 700 wives and 300 concubines. And the one that he's super proud of is that he actually married a daughter of Pharaoh. That has not happened before. So as we look at this in pictorial form, this is what Solomon does to Israel. From the Arm of the Euphrates, that's the western border of superpower one, all the way to the Wadi of Egypt, that's the eastern boundary of superpower number two, Solomon controls the entire land bridge between the superpowers of the ancient world. And let me put just two more details on your slide. Those are the international highways. That is the Via Maris, where I come from now. It's the 101. And it's the King's Highway, which is probably more like Route 5 and doesn't get blocked up quite as often. Okay, these are the trade routes. He's taken control of Eilat. He's taken control of Sidon and Tyre. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. This man is making it happen, and there is money flowing, flowing, flowing. Solomon establishes an actual empire. And all testimonies in the text are because of wisdom. So now let's circle back to wisdom literature itself. As was the Solomonic age, so was wisdom literature. Solomon has tapped into every other nation out there, either by ship or by highway. The Queen of Sheba is coming. All the men of all the nations have heard of his wisdom, and they're coming to him to learn from him. And Solomon is learning from them as well. Wisdom literature is the highest brow intellectual endeavor known to Solomon's world. This is philosophy, epistemology, theology. Only PhDs controlled this stuff. That's why when Job has his great agony and his three friends show up, I speak of them as the department chair of the School of Divinity at Duke. I speak of them as the dean of biblical studies at Cornell University and the headmaster coming from Cambridge. It was a very secular genre, but a secular genre that was of incredible respect. Its message, wisdom literature basically claims that you don't have to learn via the school of hard knocks. Rather, you can set yourself under a mentor and be schooled without the scars that it usually takes to learn this material. So indeed, wisdom literature is an international genre, but our wisdom literature within the text is always going to operate off of this thesis. All of this philosophy, all of this epistemology, are you a modern, a pre-modern, or a postmodern? Are you Hegelian? Are you a Darwinist? Are you a Marxist? Are you a capitalist? Fiddle-dee-dee, these folks will say. All of these schools of thought will pass along the way. But the fear of Yahweh, that is the beginning of true wisdom. And this, when Solomon begins his career, is what he's got down. So how would we describe this genre? It is the discipline of applying truth to one's life in light of experience. This room is full of people who know how to do that. It is always focused on behavior. Isn't that interesting? Wisdom literature is not going to tell you to pray and fast. It's going to tell you to get up earlier, put on better clothes, and work harder. It is going to appeal to reason, experience, and human initiative. It is also going to interact constantly with this foil between the wise man and the fool. Now, when I was that new convert at the age of 15 and someone gave me that New Testament with the book of Proverbs slapped onto the back and I started reading it because that's what they told me I was supposed to do, I was kind of offended. Because the God of the universe that I'd just been introduced to kept calling people fool. And I was like, oh gosh, my parents wouldn't let me do that and they don't believe in anything. What's the deal? I did not realize, and neither would any other 15-year-old, that the wise man and the fool are being set up as a foil throughout this literature. What is the wise man? The wise man is not the person who is super smart and never makes mistakes. The wise person is the person who recognizes that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and when they fall down seven times, Proverbs 24, they get up eight. When they're caught in a sin, they repent, they don't rationalize. That's who a wise person is. The fool, on the other hand, is the one who won't accept discipline, the one who's never wrong, the one who always rationalizes, the one who goes down seven times and stays down. And these two characters play out throughout this literature. This literature, as we will see, that includes Job, Ecclesiastes, the book of Proverbs, and some would say the Song of Songs as well. To quote Walter Brueggemann, wisdom consistently places stress on human freedom, accountability, the importance of making decisions, making good decisions, the freedom, power, and responsibility of humanity to manage that, their world. This is wisdom literature. One of the questions we've got to ask ourselves is, what does it look like when it comes into our canon? Well, one thing is it's going to come in two literary categories. The first one is going to be aphoristic sayings, which are little collections of wise, memorizable maxims of succinct truth. In other words, the book of Proverbs. You might be interested to know that we have an exact same collection coming out of Egypt. It's called the Instructions of Amenhotep. Doesn't have the same material necessarily, but it's the same sort of collection. And actually, someone, probably Solomon, lifted a section out of it, Proverbs 22 to 24, and dropped it into your Bible, pretty much lock, stock, and barrel. And the Instructions of Amenhotep date to 1000 BC. Wonder how that got in there. All right, Dialogues on the Meaning of Life, Job is one of those. We have the Mesopotamian parallel, Ludlu Bel Nimiki, or the Babylonian Theodicy. What do you do with a righteous sufferer? And look at those dates. Ecclesiastes, which is also a dialogue on the meaning of life, also has a parallel in Mesopotamia, which is called the Dialogue of Pessimism. And it doesn't end nearly as well as the book of Ecclesiastes does. Now, each of these categories of wisdom lit was known to Israel's broader world, and each one was designed to be read and understood in a certain fashion. And interesting to us as well, each came in the form of poetry and high eloquence. And I'm afraid I don't have time to talk about that, but very interesting stuff. So let's take a look at the aphoristic saying first. And Terry, I'm assuming that I'm taking my 40 minutes, even though we started a little late. Okay, I'm good. All right, he says I'm good, you can't leave. That's all there is to it. Okay, all right, so aphoristic sayings, the book of Proverbs, the first thing we want to ask ourselves is, what is a proverb? Now, something I find so fun in the classroom is that every culture has its own proverbs. And if you've come, let's say you have Romanian relatives or French Canadian relatives or African relatives, you've been raised with particular proverbs. Now in Hebrew, it's called a mashal, and it's defined as a figure of speech, a parable, a specially contrived saying. Why is it specially contrived? So that you can memorize it, stupid. That's the whole point. Memorize it, and that particular statement, which expresses a practical truth, might help you stop from being stupid for the rest of your life. These are brief, crisp maxims, usually found in a series, yet mutually independent. That was one of my problems with the book slapped onto my New Testament. Boy, this stuff is all over the place, because I didn't recognize it was an evolving collection. Now, periodically, you will bump into Proverbs 8, which is a narrative about Lady Wisdom at the beginning, and then at the end, the narrative about the wise woman in Proverbs 31, who is her foil, perhaps, or the collection of why young men need to stay away from promiscuous women. That gets a lot of showing. But generally, it is an unrelated collection. In fact, a quote I have is that Proverbs is something like being trapped on a long road trip with your mother, or at least with William Bennett. I love that. Okay, so Proverbs are not, hear me on this, Proverbs are not promises. We have to tell our publishing companies this. Proverbs are not promises. They are not commands, and they are not prophecies. They are brief, memorizable maxims of truth. So, for example, watch your pennies, and the dollars will take care of themselves. Snitches get stitches. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Or perhaps a stitch in time saves nine. Look before you leap. Stupid is as stupid does. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Mess with the bull, you get the horns. Who was raised with that one? Yeah, me too. And I got the horns plenty of times. A penny saved is a penny earned. When elephants fight, the grass is trampled. I learned that one from a past colleague, Tapiwa Mucherera. Steve Moore will remember him. He was from Africa. I love that statement. When the elephants fight, the grass is trampled. Another one he gave me, a little more comical. If you find a turtle in a tree, you know he did not get there by himself. Okay, these are proverbs. And one of my recent favorites is this one. Or, ladies in the room, ready? Yeah, okay, there we go. So a proverb is not a promise, and yet we inscribe in the front of every junior high Bible we pass out in Sunday school, trust in the Lord with all your heart, do not lean on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. That's true, but is it a promise? Well, if it is, then so is this. As the churning of milk produces butter, and pressing the nose brings forth blood, so the churning of anger produces strife. I sure hope that's not a promise. And just to sneak in a little bit on Hebrew poetry, do you see the seconding there? The little parallelism there? Okay, maybe next time. Or perhaps this. There is abundant food in the fallow ground of the poor, but it is swept away by injustice. A promise? I sure hope not. Or this one. Okay. I will not ask for a show of hands, but how many of us have this on a cross stitch, a refrigerator magnet, or framed in our child's bedroom? How many of us have kneeled next to the bed of our 17-year-old emerging adolescent and prayed this proverb over them? Okay, I'm going to blame this on Gordon Hugenberger, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. He pointed out that in Hebrew, the pronoun is actually ambiguous. This probably does not mean train up a child in their faith and when they're old they'll come back to it. It probably means let your 7-year-old get away with murder now. Don't stop him, don't discipline him. And at 27, he'll still be living in your basement, mooching off your refrigerator and driving your car. That is probably what it means. You might not want to tell your grandmother. Okay. So those are proverbs, how to read dialogues addressing the meaning of life. We're going to hit this one quick because we are actually focusing in on the book of Ecclesiastes. The first thing is you need to realize that the dialogues addressing the meaning of life are a whole book, and they have to be read as a whole book. If you just pull one little bit or snatch of wisdom out of Job or Ecclesiastes, you're going to wind up either foolish or a heretic. And neither of these are good endings. For example, another song from the Byrds. Come on, Tara, you're with me. A time to be born, a time to die. I don't have the video. We quote this, and we try to comfort ourselves with the idea that God is sovereign over all things, and all things are appointed, and it's going to be okay. When in reality, Koheleth is saying life is completely meaningless. You're born, you work your tail off, you die, you rot in the ground. Big deal. That's what he's actually saying in the larger context of his book. It is not that God ordains the time of our birth and death. It is actually that life is completely futile, unless you read the whole book. So let's focus in on the few minutes that we have left on the book of Ecclesiastes, because this is where I want you, as the movers and shakers of my world, to land. And I want you to hear the wisdom of the book of Ecclesiastes. And to do this, I need to give you a little bit more history. I've given you the light side of Solomon's story. I've given you all of his successes. Well, there is a dark side to Solomon's government as well. His ever-expanding bureaucracy meant that he was buying people's children in order to serve in his courts. It meant that he was stroking the back of those who stroked his, and he was ever-expanding the table, the royal table, and the dean treats that he was handing out to his constituency. It meant that this man took 700 wives and 300 concubines. Okay, that is a busy man. I'm just saying. All right. It means that now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites. Solomon clung to these women in love. And when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. For Solomon went after the Ashtoreth, that's the goddess of the Canaanites, and after Milcom, that's the god you sacrifice your children to, the abomination of the Ammonites. What else happened on the dark side of Solomon's government? He alienated most of his constituency. How did he do that? He imposed 12 tax districts on top of the 12 tribes. All right, so for a tribal federation that believes that their land has been gifted to them by Yahweh and they have their own indigenous leadership, and Yahweh says, well, those divisions of the land are not efficient, I'm going to impose 12 tax districts on top. I'm going to delegitimize the indigenous leadership that is taking away my influence, and I'm going to more efficiently shake out the change of my impoverished farmers. How do you think that went over? And then there's this thing called corvée labor, where people are expected to pay their taxes in labor. So you actually have to show up at the king's monumental building project 1 month out of three and give your labor away to him for free. And how is it going to go with a subsistence farmer when he has to leave his farm 1 month out of three? And then when Solomon needs to pay off the Phoenicians for all their help with his building projects, he pays them by giving away 10 of the cities that belonged to his people that were gifted to them by their God Yahweh. Now, your town might not be much, but it's yours. And if you woke up tomorrow and found out you actually belong to Nicaragua, you might be a little upset about that. So the passage reads, King Solomon drafted forced labor. It's the same words as the slaves in Egypt. King Solomon drafted forced labor out of all of Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 men a month in shifts. They would be a month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Solomon also had 70,000 burden bearers and 80,000 stone cutters. Besides Solomon's 3,300 chief officers who were over the work, taskmasters, who had charge of the people who carried on the work, at the king's command, they quarried out great costly stones in order to lay the foundation of the house, that's the temple, with dressed stones. So Solomon's builders and Hiram of Phoenicians' builders and the men of Gebal did the cutting and preparing the timber and the stone to build the house, and Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold as much as he desired, and King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. What else is a part of his dark side? His legacy according to the National Historian, is the divided monarchy. He split his constituency because he treated those who were not like himself differently than he treated his home tribe. Judah got all the benefits, and the 10 northern tribes got all the weight and burden of his successes. So if you're familiar with my little handy-dandy timeline that comes out of Seedbed, this is the United Monarchy, and according to the National Historian, the Great Civil War that divided this kingdom, never to be reunited again, is Solomon's fault. This is a leader who blew it. This is a wise man who didn't stay wise. And the thing that always strikes me about these biblical narratives is it's the average Jane and Joe living in their village, believing themselves to be a faithful citizen of the kingdom of God, who catches it right between the eyes. When we blow it, folks, it's not just us who suffer. And this kingdom is split down the middle. And how interesting it is that if we cycle all the way back to the Constitution and bylaws of Israel, that would be the book of Deuteronomy. I was interviewed on radio by Moody Radio just on Monday, and this guy actually asked me, why would anyone want to read the book of Deuteronomy? Me, they asked that question. Okay, so it's the Constitution and bylaws of Israel. And Yahweh says to them, when you come to the land and the Lord your God is giving you, and you say, I want to set a king over me like all the nations around me, okay, that's all right. But your king must not acquire many horses for himself. He must not acquire many wives for himself. He must not acquire excessive silver and gold. Rather, he shall write a copy for himself, a copy of this law, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he will learn to, you hear our thesis again, fear the Lord his God. Now, is it that horses, wives, and silver and gold are bad? No, it is where you're placing your confidence as a leader. Where is your confidence? Where is your allegiance? And what Deuteronomy is saying is your allegiance has to be straight. So this takes us back to the book of Ecclesiastes. And the book of Ecclesiastes actually has two voices in it. The first voice we can find in chapter 1. And this voice is the voice of the frame. And the frame comes at the beginning of the end. And the middle of the book, starting with chapter 2 and running through, about 11, is probably an ancient wisdom piece that Solomon has borrowed from another nation, and he's passed it through his Yahwistic lens with his frame. And the frame is, these are the words of Koheleth, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. And he starts off saying, meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And he announces his research project. I am going to explore all the brass rings of this world, the pleasure, the fame, the conquest, the building, the wealth, and I'm going to find out where joy is. I'm going to find out where real success is. But as he rehearses throughout the book, he learns that everything is actually utterly vacuous. Why? He'll tell you in chapter 12, because death and injustice strip it all away. I'm born today, I'm incredibly successful, and you know what? I'm going to die next week. And you know what else? I'm really talented, and I'm really committed, and I've worked my tail off, but the system is so corrupt, I am never going to break through the glass ceiling. Death and injustice. What is that great quote about old age and corruption will always win out over youth and talent? I need to throw that into my PowerPoint. This is what Solomon discovers. Meaningless, meaningless. The sun rises, the sun sets, and it hurries back to where it rises. None of these things will satisfy. Rather, they all make life absurd. This is the old piece of wisdom. This is nihilism. This is where the world is headed until Solomon gets a hold of this book. He speaks the old words. The eye never has enough of seeing. The ear never has enough of hearing. What has been will be again. There's nothing new under the sun. There's no remembrance of the men of old. And those who are yet to come will not remember those who follow. Let's all get a kitchen knife because this stinks. Until we get to the epilogue. And in the epilogue, this is what Solomon announces. He says, now, all has been heard. When all has been heard, here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. Do you hear the thesis? For this is the whole duty of humanity. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. Now, you need to superimpose the book of Ecclesiastes over Solomon's life because it's intentional, folks. Because Solomon starts off well, and then he spins into his unrestrained appetites. And sometimes those unrestrained appetites look really good. Those unrestrained appetites are not necessarily pornography or drugs or promiscuity. Those unrestrained appetites can be work and productivity and getting a network and getting it out there, right? He loses control with his unrestrained appetites and he spins into disaster. And what Ecclesiastes is telling us is that at the end of his life, he pulls it back in. That's what the book is trying to tell us. Now, guys, I make my emerging adults read this book from start to finish in one sitting, and I make them come back to class ready to have a conversation about it. I ask those 18 and 19-year-olds of mine the following question. What do you think of Qoheleth? Do you think this writer is, like, totally neurotic? Do you think he's an honest doubter? Or do you think something else? And do you think this book is actually still relevant to you and to your generation? Now, Westmont does not require a faith statement of its incoming students. By the way, send us all your people. We're really good. Okay, so I've got students sitting in front of me that are, I am not a Christian. I am not interested in this. This is a GE and it's required. And they read this book. And I see the transformation of their faces. They come back stunned because they find themselves in the pages of Qoheleth's book. They recognize that the message of eat, drink, and marry, for tomorrow we die, is all over their world. And their own souls, young as they are, know that it is all futility. That the grab it while you can mentality is vacuous. And even by the tender age of 20, they've figured out that it doesn't work, that there is no return on that investment. And they talk about this book and how this book must be taught in every youth group and every college Bible study if they ever survive the storm, if they are ever to survive the storms and vagaries of their own lives. They find in this book hope. Hope that they can learn from someone who's older as they start the journey. And as my students say, yes, you know what? Life without something bigger, and they whisper in the back of their minds, God, is meaningless. And I am always so impressed by the wisdom that they gain from reading this book that you would think they had no interest in. And so after we have the discussion, and this is where I wanted to take you, and I'm just about done here. When they're done, I throw in my two cents, and I say to them what I'm going to say to you. The book of Ecclesiastes, the tale of Solomon's own journey in a certain way, where he went beyond real wisdom and pursued all of the narcissistic and hedonistic pleasures of his world, and he came back empty. I remind my students that the vast majority of us humans, we live out our lives with limited resources. And we are all convinced that if only we were as rich or as beautiful or as powerful or as well-networked or as promoted as that other guy, then we'd be happy. Then the hole inside would finally be filled. But the rest of us can't get all that stuff. And so we keep plugging along, and the hope of the golden prize at the end of the golden ladder gives us sanity. What happens when you actually get to the top of the golden ladder? What happens when you actually get all the money, power, fame, and good looks that anyone could ever ask for? That is what makes the book of Ecclesiastes unique and critical to the beginning of our wisdom discussion. Solomon speaks with profound authority regarding this very issue because he, unlike the rest of us mediocre Janes and Joes, had all the wealth, power, women, and prestige that any of us could ever dream of. Yet in this book, he says they're all empty. This guy, who had it all and everybody knew it, actually climbs to the very top of the golden ladder. He looks over the top and he says, oh my goodness, it's all a lie. It's a lie. And he has the wherewithal to climb back down the ladder and to tell the rest of us. What happens to people when they get it all? What happens to people when all the fame, power, prestige, money, and popularity actually lands right in their lap? You know the stories of every person on that screen. And every one of them started to self-destruct. I'm very glad to say that some of them are on the road back. They began to self-medicate. They began to self-destroy. This spouse doesn't work, let me try another. This relationship doesn't make me happy, let me go for another. They lost their kids, they lost their wives, they lost their jobs, they lost their health, they lost their fame and their fortune. Why? And I will say the why is because they actually got to the top of the golden ladder and they saw that it was a lie. And where would you be if you had given everything you had to get to the top of that ladder and you found out there was nothing there? You would self-destruct. Unlike these contemporaries of our days, Solomon steps back, climbs back down the ladder, and looks at my students who are 19, and looks at me and looks at us and says, guys, there's nothing up there. This is the end of the matter. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Hold it tight, because every force in this universe is going to be trying to pry it out of our hands. Thank you very much.